Today's episode of A Slice of Medieval. We have a wonderful treat today with a very special guest. In his time, David Gilman has been a paratrooper, firefighter, and photographer. He's now an award-winning screenwriter and author. His Master of War series is, quite frankly, incredible. Set in the Hundred Years' War, it follows the adventures of Thomas Blackstone, and book number 8, To Kill a King, has just been released. Welcome, David, and congratulations on the latest book.
Well, thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Pleasure to meet you too. I've been reading the Master of War series from the beginning, so it's nice to actually finally put a face to the writer.
Yeah, thank you. It's always the case that your invisible audience is out there.
Definitely. So just for those who haven't been such avid readers as I am, To Kill a King is the 8th book in the Master of War series. Can you give us a brief review of Thomas Blackstone's career so far?
Oh, right. Well, it goes back, let's see, he's about 20 years on now, I suppose, from when we started. He was a 16-year-old stonemason who cared for his brother, who was, if the terminology is probably not correct these days, but he was deaf-mute, a big lumbering child who was used for all kinds of things except conversation and anything else, and he was accused of rape. And with Thomas Blackstone being his guardian, they both would have hanged had they been convicted. So off they went to war. And this was 1346. So we're now in 13, where are we now? 1367. So he's come a long way. He started off as an archer. And the reason is, I think I started him at that age. I wanted a reader to get a sense of, obviously, the time, but also that a 16-year-old going to war and the effect it had on him. So through the eyes of a 16-year-old, that first conflict, what it meant. And I think that worked. I hope that worked. And so it went on from there. But at the Battle of Crecy, in trying to save his brother, he actually rescued the Prince of Wales, who was in the vanguard of the battle and who was the same age as Blackstone. Very conveniently, might I add. So he saves him, and he suffers terrible wounds. He really nearly dies on the battlefield. And the king, King Edward, who was there, of course, said to his son, well, you know, this guy saved your life. He needs to be honoured. So they knighted Blackstone as a 16-year-old. And then he went into his recovery. So that was the start of his time, as it were. And then he went on to be trained because he could no longer use, he was an archer, did I mention that? He was,
yes,
a bowman,
yeah.
Yeah, thank you. He was then trained into sword fighting, and he stayed with Jean de Harcourt in France. And then men came to him, and slowly but surely, he built up this group of men around him. And he was quite defiant of the king. There wasn't a lot more to do at that stage with the Prince of Wales. And then as time went on, he became so efficient as a leader, a commander of these men, never more than about 100. I always kept it quite low numbers. That he was made eventually King Edward's Master of War. And that has taken the story on and on and on through the conflicts of that period of the Hundred Years' War. Does that help?
Yes, I'm sure it does. So you've done all these things. You've written lots of screenplays and all the rest of it. Why did you decide to embark on this Hundred Years' War series?
I don't really know. I tell you what happened. I had finished writing A Touch of Frost, which was my TV work here. I then wrote three young adult novels, which did extremely well around the world. And I was about to start a crime series. I thought I'd write a crime series of books. It seemed to be the most obvious place to go anyway. And my wife goes to an art class for a couple of hours on a Tuesday afternoon. And she came back to the house with a painting. It wasn't very big, it was a miniature. It's a well-known painting of a Renaissance man on a big war horse. She came in, she said, "This is what I've done today." Put it down. I thought, "Very nice, thank you very much." Carried on with my research, whatever I was doing, thinking about crime. And I looked at this picture and I thought, "I've seen that before. Where have I seen it?" And it was painted by an Italian artist called Pierluigi. And where I had seen it was quite a few years previously in the Duomo in Florence. And I twigged. And I looked it up. And it was, of course, a painting of a guy called Giovanni Acuto. So who the heck is Giovanni Acuto? And of course, that's Sir John Hawkwood, who is an English mercenary, who was an English mercenary fighting in Italy. And I thought, well, I didn't know we had English mercenaries fighting in Italy. So I started looking him up. And then I thought, well, hang on. If he was there, why can't I write a story about a young man going to war? And so there you are. Curiosity killed the cat, and off we went. And that's when I started. But I really wanted to have it from a young man's perspective, as I said, going to war, protecting his brother, and events that unfold eventually make him a great soldier. And that's where it started. And I was only going to write one book.
Yeah, so I was
It
going to
was
say, did you intend a series or
no, one book, that was it. And then I was going to go and do something else. So then they said, "Well, hang on a moment. Could we continue?" So here I am. So that's the eighth book done.
It's certainly done very well, and Sharon and I obviously have both read them, so we know why it's done well. But
Thank you.
it's quite a difference from a crime series.
Just a bit.
Although there is crime in
Quite a bit in it, actually.
it.
One of the real characters in it is Edward the Black Prince, and he features quite a bit in To Kill a King and the earlier books. What is your take on him? Was he a great general or was he overhyped?
I don't think he was overhyped. You've got this strange contradiction going on at this period of time. These were very pious men. They prayed. They acknowledged their successes to God. They gave to the poor. They had chivalric feelings about everything, but they were also terribly brutal when it came to fighting. And when you think that this 16-year-old Prince of Wales at the Battle of Crecy, let's start there, at the Battle of Crecy in 1346, he actually was in the vanguard of the battle. And it was a heck of a battle. And when it looked as though he was about to be overpowered, history tells us that they went to the king and said, "Look, shouldn't we sort of send a few more reinforcements down to help him out there?" And the king said, "Well, he's got to take his chances." And so that tells me there's enormous guts and courage that you stand there and you do that. And as time went on, and don't forget, he then went on and beat the French at Poitiers and captured the French king. He was a good soldier and very brave, I think. And there's always going to be conflicting reports about him, So no, I think he was. I don't think he was overhyped at all. But what he did have was a taste of luxury, and he would always overspend, shall we say, more than he had in the bank. And when he eventually came down to be the Duke of Aquitaine, the Prince of Wales and Aquitaine. Aquitaine at that time was actually very poor, but his father said, "Well, you go, you run it. We need to have somebody down on that border of the Pyrenees. Get yourself down there, sort it out." But there was very little in the way of produce that came out of there. So the only way they could really raise money was through taxation and what have you. But the French were always pressing on the borders. It was that that brought me to Kill a King. because across the Pyrenees, of course, we had Dom Pedro the Cruel. So they needed the allies, and there was an alliance in place anyway. So he just loved to have big parties, big bashes, tournaments, and he would gift everybody all these things, huge feasts. And that is quite a nice contrast for me to have between Thomas Blackstone and the Prince of Wales. There's always this love-hate relationship between them. So that works well for me, at least in the novels.
Yeah, it's interesting that Edward III didn't seem too bothered whether his heir was killed at Cressy or not. Whereas, with many reigns, the king is so protective of his sort of eldest son. But I guess he had quite a lot of sons.
Derek, I think it was more a case of the heir to the throne being blooded in the battle. And don't forget, he had marshals of the army around him as well. He wasn't out there on his own. He had men around him, of course. And I think it was a case of the king watching his son's actions in that battle, letting him be blooded, seeing that he was sufficiently protected, that he hadn't gone to ground, he hadn't been forced down. And so I think he was playing it very close to his chest, those cards, because you are watching your son and heir. Now, is he going to die or is he going to live? But the fact that he was being blooded in that battle was a warrior class, and we can't appreciate that. We sit here and we think, oh, okay, they went to war. No, it was horrendous brutality. And so you've got to give the guy some kudos for that, I think.
And it probably wasn't the Black Prince who actually asked for reinforcements. It was probably the people around him who were getting a little worried.
Absolutely.
And they're in charge of the prince,
Yeah.
so they want to make sure he's safe.
Yeah.
Whereas the Black Prince wants to prove to his dad that he can do it, because 16-year-olds are like that, aren't
Yeah,
they?
I think you're absolutely right, Sharon. It's but again, we can only surmise, can't we? But there it was. That is history.
And of course, it's not just the king looking on, it's everyone else.
Yes.
So how the young heir behaves and conducts himself in those pressurized situations was an indicator to everybody else what the next king might be like. So I guess it was important.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's how these families at the time were built. But when on the other side of the coin, John the Good of France wasn't a particularly good soldier. Thought he was, but he wasn't. So they had their pride, and that's why they just stayed on their horses, and they kept coming, and they kept coming, and they kept dying, and they kept dying. They just couldn't see that to get off your horse and fight, that was ungentlemanly to them. So they paid the price.
I was going to ask you if Blackstone was based on a real character, but you've kind of suggested that Sir John Hawkwood was at least not, if not a model for the character, was an inspiration for the character.
I think he was only a Trigonite. And the one thing I did not want to do was to write a story about an existing known character. I really didn't want to do that. I mean, there's enough history for me to put my man into, so we can see what sort of response and reaction, where we go and what happens and doesn't happen. But I just didn't want to do that. So yes, as a trigger, thanks to that painting, and if anybody goes to Florence and you go into the Duomo, this thing is like 5 meters high. You can't miss it. What I didn't know at the time was when I started looking, say, well, who is this Giovanni Acuto guy? And I read briefly about it, and that's where, as I said before, that's where I got the idea from, the trigger. But they were going to bury him in Florence. He was going to be buried there. They'd actually built a monument for him. And the English king at the time, who was Richard, turned around and said, "Well, can we have him back?" And they sent his remains back to England. So that's where he ended up. But he married one of the Visconti as well, the Visconti daughters. If I'm correct, yeah, I think he did, yeah. So there we are. But no, he was a trigger, Derek. Let's stay with my fictional character, I think.
Well, you have so much more flexibility anyway, don't you?
But again, within that flexibility, the flexibility has to be, doesn't it? As you put your character, your fictional character, into history. So he has to be part of that historical time.
Yeah.
And within that, you write his story, which can go off in different tangents, but he has to be in that period,
Yeah.
in that battle, in that time, whatever was going on.
Yeah.
So you have the specific dates and
Yes,
events
absolutely.
so that Thomas manages to make each of the events but has his own story going on as well.
Yeah.
That's how it has to be. Yeah, you can't just regurgitate history. That's not historical fiction.
That's answered my next question, actually, because it was how hard is it to write a fictional character into the historical narrative? So I'm guessing it's actually easier than to write a historical narrative, because if you were just writing history, you have no flexibility to work a story into it, do you?
No, you've got, I mean, it's not difficult. Well, I don't think it's difficult. I take it on the chin and get on with it. You've got to unfold your story against the backdrop. And don't forget, quite often, just because there's a big event, shall we say, you can take part in that event and then scoot off somewhere. It's not difficult putting a fictional character in there, but you don't forget you are also bringing in a lot of non-fictional characters, the lords of the women, the kings, the queens, and
Yeah.
all of that. If they're there and they're mentioned, they're there, they've got to be there for a reason. But the focus for the reader has got to be the character you have created, and take your reader with you, obviously, as you know, and take him through that part of history. You could probably write the whole eight novels set in 2 years if you really wanted to, but
Yeah.
there wasn't a lot going on in that condensed period of time. So thank you, history.
But it's also quite nice to get that character development, not just the main character, but other characters around them. And also, as they grow older, things change, relationships, and
Yeah.
so on. So, all of that provides a sort of good area for invention as well, doesn't it?
Well, what I enjoy about the Master of War series, and I think this is what my readers enjoy as well, is we've basically got a band of brothers. And within that group, you've got the characters, you've got the black humor, you've got crudity at times, you've got pathos. That band of brothers, as we know, always
Yeah.
works as a theme. And if you get the right character mix, it works well for the reader.
Yeah, there's kind of something for everyone, isn't there? There's a bit of humor, as you say, and that, but along with the violence and so on, it's a good mix.
It is a good mix, but I also like to, once I got the character established, I was very keen to, if it worked genuinely, I was very keen to always bring in a strong woman into the series. And that's why when Blackstone married very young, the young girl who had nursed him from his battle wounds at Crecy, and they married, that in itself gave me another thread to the whole series. And what they went through as a family, because he had two young children, he had his son and his daughter. And the introduction of the son, Henry, played a bit, quite a key part in the earlier days, because there was an attempted rape on his mother in the boat on his way to Avon to safety. Young Henry, the very young Henry, tried to save his mother. And that then gave me a core element for the son, Henry. And because his mother was French, and she had taught him to read and write and love poetry, it gave that character another dimension, which was a dimension that his father didn't have.
Yeah.
And so as the series progress and progresses, they can cause conflict. They can also highlight Blackstone's feelings against his son or for his son against and for the father, and the interthreads go on and on.
And because Henry's grown up with Blackstone, not just with Blackstone, but with Blackstone men, I love in To Kill a King, they all feel that they're entitled to give their opinion
Yeah.
to Blackstone
Yeah.
about what Henry should be allowed to do.
Yeah, I think we've reached that stage. Yeah. And you're quite right that he did spend time with those men. But I think I established in a couple of the earlier books as well that he's very brave.
Yeah.
He's a brave young man. But that's not what his father wants from him. His father wants him to pursue his education. The guy speaks Latin, he speaks French, English. You've got a better life than me, son.
Yeah.
That's that.
Yeah, As soon as you introduce the father-son dynamic, you have something different,
Yes.
don't you? You have a new strand.
I think it works at every level, frankly, because I've introduced that. You've had the death of his wife, where Blackstone basically went to pieces when she was killed. You know, he actually went to pieces. We thought that was the end of Blackstone. And his men came and found him and got him out of his drunken stupor and got him back on his feet. So that all brings those men together and carries the series forward again. So I think there is, hopefully, for the reader, a strong sense of identification with these characters.
Certainly. I've really enjoyed the different dynamics within the group and the part played by the sort of the other characters in how the whole story moves forward. I think that's been terrific. And in this book with Henry, you've got that added kind of threat, that added kind of sense of danger and worry and so on, which can't be there without children. It's a different kind of thing.
I have to say, to write To Kill a King, I knew what I had an idea of what I wanted to do, obviously, with bringing Henry in. It was time to bring him in because he's now, what, 19, 20 years old. But I really enjoyed creating the characters around him because they were different again from Blackstone's men. And I really enjoyed that. But I did find it took me a long time, the structure of the book, which I'm sure you'll appreciate, to structure that book so that I didn't take too much away from Blackstone, gave Henry Blackstone enough to do, and then create enough threat for both of them. But the threat that eventually came because of the son, if you see what I mean. The structure really was a headache. It took me a while to get that sorted.
Well, you've got the sort of total balance in the thing, but you've also got the timing of chapters and when you move from one to the other, and keeping your readers on side in a sense as you go from one story to the other.
I think you've always got to bear in mind that when you go off on a tangent and you take your reader with you, you've actually got to remind them of what's going on. And I've read some books with these different character shifts, and I keep thinking, well, hang on a minute, who's this person? And I've got to go back a few chapters. Now, hopefully, I haven't caused that to be a problem, but I do think there's the, you know what I mean when I say there's the undercurrent of knowledge for the reader. You keep them in the game, as it were. They've got to know, oh, okay, now Henry's now, okay, yes, now I see what's happening now. Oh, now Blackstone, the last time we left him, and there he is, he picked him up again. And so, you know, it's just the means of bringing it together.
I must say, I did have a few instances where it changed chapters and it was like it went from Henry's story to Thomas's or vice versa. And I was like, oh, yeah, he's in the book as well because I'm so absorbed in the one story that I would have happily carried on with Henry's story. And then Thomas's turns up and it's like, oh, I'd happily carry on with Thomas's. Sometimes when you're doing a dual story like that, the reader doesn't get enough of one particular person before it switches to the next. But with To Kill a King, there was, you got absorbed in Henry's story before it switched to Thomas's.
You're quite right, Sharon. You've got to give it enough time to immerse yourself, because to me, when I write these things, it's a totally immersive thing. I mean, you know, I'm in cloud cuckoo land half the time. You know, they don't ask me what day it is. You know, it's sometime in 1367. It's a Friday, I think. You know, it's that kind of thing. But you're quite right. You've got to give the reader enough time to take a breath and say, "Wow, okay, we've let who? Okay, now with Henry." You know, it's that split. It's like two books in one. I know, but there's joined up writing, if that
Oh,
makes
yeah,
sense.
definitely.
So it is a skill. I think we've all got it, you know, to greater or lesser degree. I hope we've pulled it off in this book. And just to get those threads to link in and then get all the other stories in as well.
I think the first mention of Henry is the critical one for me, where the reader is suddenly thrown somewhere else. He's thrown to Oxford or wherever when he's been down in Aquitaine or wherever. And that's where you need to hook the reader on that story so that he knows, oh, yeah, actually, this is quite interesting as well. Rather than it being some kind of diversion that the reader's thinking, come on, let's get back to the real story. There's got to be that hook at the start, hasn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, and that's the sort of That's the sort of young man he is. You know, he's bonking away, and he's got the guy outside the door. You know, so as young men do.
I can't remember.
Yes. No, let's not go there.
Absolutely. So, one of the great characters in the book is Pedro the Cruel,
Yeah.
who appears to be very aptly named. Sometimes kings aren't, but yes, he must be an absolute gift, Pedro the Cruel, isn't he, to a novelist?
Well, the strange thing is, the English had an alliance with Pedro because he was across in Castile and Leon. Now, the alliance was always that if he got into trouble, we'd go and help out. And of course, with Aquitaine now, where we are in 1367, there's the prince. He's down there. He's got the French to the east. He's got the Pyrenees. Then he's got Pedro on the other side. So Pedro the Cruel really did get that name quite aptly. His half bastard brother, Henry of Trastamara, was just as bad, let me tell you. But the cruel bit stuck to Pedro. Now, the alliance was going to go back a long way because, as I think he must have been about, I don't know, 15, 16 years old, Pedro was betrothed to King Edward III's daughter. And she was on her way through France. Sharon, you can correct me on this because I think you'll know better than I, but I think it must have been, it was a time of the plague and she got the plague and she died. Joan, didn't she? She died.
Yeah.
Okay. So then young Pedro didn't have a bride. So then said, okay, what we're going to do is you're going to marry Blanche de Bourbon, the French. Okay, fine. So he didn't want to, but they bring Blanche over. And history says, and I covered this in the previous book, Shadow of the Hawk, that Pedro actually had Blanche de Bourbon killed because he was really in love with his mistress, Maria de Padil, Padille. I don't know how to pronounce it in Spanish, frankly. Excuse me. Anyway, Maria. So that's how he, that one of the reasons he was called Pedro the Cruel. But the big reason was he had enticed his, I don't know whether it was younger or his older brother, I can't remember, to dinner because he was a threat to the throne. So he has him, there's the banquet table. So there's Pedro. And he basically chases his brother around the room, chops him to pieces, and then sits down and has dinner. You think, oh, this is a real piece of work, this is, you know, that's Pedro the Cruel for you. And in To Kill a King, I reflected an incident where Pedro kills the man that Blackstone had saved. And in reality, at the Battle of Najera, he actually did slaughter, he murdered prisoners. So he lived up to his reputation, you know. But what was interesting for me, just stepping back a moment to the previous book, Shadow of the Hawk, where Thomas Blackstone went across the Pyrenees to rescue Dom Pedro, to take him back to Aquitaine, which was basically the story of the whole book. Pedro had been excommunicated by the Pope because he had a deal with the Moors in Granada, the Emirate in Granada. And of course, Christianity and Islam, they were always the enemy. But if you look at Dom Pedro's Alcazar down in Seville, it's very much Moorish architecture. He had a strong influence. So that gave me a lot for the previous book, Shadow of the Hawk, and where Blackstone really did not like this horrible man. But now in To Kill a King, he has to go back and get him back on the throne. So it gelled, if that makes sense.
It's interesting what you said about his rival Henry being just as bad, almost as bad. But, and the implication when you call somebody the cruel, the implication is that his rival is a lot better, isn't it? Somehow in the, in your head, it, that's how it kind of works. But that obviously wasn't the case.
No, clearly not. I mean, these were really mean people. You don't cross them.
You mentioned the Moors. And in the book, you also refer to the fact that Pedro allowed the Jews as well, another group who weren't always well received, shall we say. So it is sort of kind of interesting that this Pedro the Cruel actually had deals with both the Jews and the Moors, who your average Christian ruler would not look on favourably, to say the least.
I touched on both elements of the Jewish question in, as I say, the previous book, Shadow the Hawk, and this one, because there was a very good character I brought in. He was a Jewish physician. Now, just trying to think back to that book, down in Bordeaux, Prince Edward, the Prince of Wales, allowed the Jews to live in the city, but just beyond the city walls. They had their own area. Okay. It wasn't a ghetto as such. But they were tolerated and accepted, and there was no persecution. When it came to Pedro, he protected the Jews because he wanted their money to fight the wars. So there was always an ulterior motive, you know, and that is why in To Kill a King we go back to that area where the Jewish people were, and it emphasizes the reasons why. Whereas Henry of Trastamara, it bizarrely, I think, if I remember correctly, in To Kill a King, there's a group of Jewish elders come to meet Blackstone at his behest, and they say, well, they're very happy he's putting Pedro back on the throne because Henry, he's going to come and get them, you know. So there's this dichotomy, isn't there?
Well, there is with Pedro anyway, isn't there? Because there's also, yes, the nickname that's stuck is Pedro the Cruel, but his friends actually call him Pedro the Wise.
Absolutely. Well, maybe he was sensible enough to how to get the money. Maybe that's what it was. I don't know, but I mean, you can delve into that as much as you like, but it does stick, this Pedro the Cruel.
It does.
It is contentious because there was a courtier. Sorry, I'm just scraping my memory here. I think his name was Ayla, Ayla, something like that. And he was a chronicler of the times. And I think it was he who named him Pedro the Cruel. So they said, well, this guy had a beef, you know, he had an axe to grind. So it's history. There you have it.
It happens a lot. Chroniclers have a heck of a lot more power than people give them credit for.
Absolutely. Look at Jean de Froissart, who chronicled this guy really embellished stuff, you know. And you have to go to other historians who've debunked a lot of it. You've got to do your research to say, well, hang on. Wasn't quite like that, thank you very much, you know.
It's just I think a lot
No.
of the time they're accepted as right, it just because they wrote it down. It's like, well, it's written in a chronicle, so it must be true. And it's like, yeah, well, you do have to look at what they're trying to say and whose side they're on.
Well, I think as well as authors, as writers, that we, you know how long it takes to do research. I mean, digging out research takes ages for me anyway. It does, you know. And I often get to a page and think, well, hang on, I didn't know what happened then. I go back, get the books out, and here we go. Oh, I see where we're going now. That takes the time. But if you just read the one chronicle, you're there. It's all done for you. Thank you very much. And fine, it's a good guide. And still, there are a lot of elements that are true. So you've got to play with it. And let's face it, we're writing historical fiction.
It's easier for historical fiction. I mean, I've done it with historical fact, and it's like I write something down, and it's like, oh, this chronicler says this, and I carry on because I just think, right, he said it, so it's fine, I can have that. And then I carry on writing about something else, come back, look at a different chronicler, and it's like, he said the exact opposite.
Yes, I
How's
know. Yes, I know.
that
Absolutely right. It's
fair?
it can be a minefield.
It is.
And I have to say, I'm much happier writing historical fiction than what you're doing. It's too much like hard work.
What you said about ongoing research is quite interesting because I think some young writers, sort of new to the task, as it were, think that you do your research, then you write the book. But it doesn't quite work out like that, does it? Because there are always times when you need to go back to the research because, as you said earlier, you get to a point where you think, hang on, I need to remind myself, or I need to find out more about this particular thing.
Well, I think it depends on the author as to where you want to tell and how you want to tell your story. Because you could have your research, shall we say, Your research is on the Battle of Poitiers. Okay, there's the battle. Is it there are enough historical books about Poitiers for you to get a really good feel who did what, where and when, where the positions were of the troops and all that. You could just have that and say, right, that is the core of my novel. And you could have a story leading into Poitiers, and you could have a story leading out of Poitiers. And the way in and the way out doesn't need research.
No,
It's a
yeah.
story. Whereas the things we tend to do with these books is the history is guiding us as to what was going on beyond that battle and pre that battle and who was on whose side and where and when. So I know it's a complication, but for me, the way I like to do it is that's nourishment for me as an author and for the reader, I think. When Henry arrives in Brittany, I thought, this is good. I'll get him into Brittany. Okay, hang on a minute. Who owned Brittany then? I knew who controlled Brittany. Of course I did. You know, I'd written about the battle in another book, Battle of Ouray. But then I thought, but hang on, within these places, within Brittany itself, there are lordships, and they were loyal to the French or loyal to the English. Which one is he in now? So when I decided which journey he had taken to get to the castle he ended up in, I realized that in fact he was in enemy hands, which suited the story, of course. And then when I don't want to give the book away, but when he gets away because of the way he gets away and he gets on the river, I had to go and find a river or a tributary of a river that took him far enough along into another domain. So that takes time. And then you turn around and say, well, hang on, how many knots does a boat take to travel so far? You know, I can go a bit too far on this, but I thought, well, okay, if he's traveling at 6 knots with the tide and he travels so and so, how far is it between there and there? Oh, I know, it'll take so many days. For heaven's sake.
Yeah, but I do the same. I mean, I hate, not that I hate to be wrong about it, but I like to try and give the reader an accurate kind of picture of what it would have been like.
Yeah.
So how far can a horse travel in,
Yeah.
in a certain terrain or whatever. So yes, I mean, it was the same when I was doing the Wars of the Roses, that you couldn't assume that one local lord, and of course it's the same in the Anarchy as well, you can't assume that because you're in a particular place, a local lord is going to be on the same side as one who's not very far away. And it's the complexity of that that I actually find quite interesting.
Well, I had somebody write to me the other day, and I know it's complicated, you know, body count and how many people. And this is fair enough. But I'm writing historical fiction, and I'm trying to create for you, the reader, a sense of reality. It's a sense of truth. That's what we're trying to do. It's the best we can do. So this guy, he's a avid reader, and he wrote to me. And he said it's really irritating. He said I'm really irritated. He said in chapter 7, he said Thomas Blackstone goes across the mountain, and he gets involved in a fight, and there are three of his men are killed. Okay, and then at the beginning of chapter 8, he said he goes back to speak to Sir Thomas to Sir Gilbert, and Sir Gilbert says, how many men did we lose? And he says, four. He said, this is really irritating. He said, I wish you'd count your bodies. So I thought, I'm so careful with this stuff. I mean, okay, you can make a mistake.
Well, I'd have been like, one died in
So I
the
actually get my book out now. This is a year ago, don't forget I wrote this. I didn't get that wrong. I know I didn't get that wrong. So I went back and I read chapter 6. And in chapter 6, one guy died then. And then the next chapter, three guys died. So when he gets back, he has four guys. So I had to write and say, go back to chapter 6 and you'll see where the fourth guy was. Read the book. But you know, to me, I want to read a book for pure pleasure. Personally, there are people who will nitpick. That's fine. I understand it can be an irritation if you miss that beat. And it's missing your beat because you can be, as a reader, as the writer, you can be so immersed in a story, you can think he's got that wrong. So I can understand it. I can well understand it because when I'm that immersed, as I'm sure you are, I am so immersed in the story, I have to go back and think, how many people did I kill today?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. That happens to me all the time.
Well, it does with your hysteric, you kill everybody.
Yeah, I do tend to kill people, it's true.
So Thomas's son had his own story in To Kill a King. Was it fun to give Henry his own storyline?
It was time. There's just a time, because don't forget he'd been in and out of the series from when he was a very young 6, 7, 8 year old, 9 years old. Then he was in Avignon, and he had to kill a man as a young man to try and save his friend. And then he was taken back to England under the king's protection. He had appeared. His character had been building. We knew he was well educated. He was sensitive, if you like. There was a sensitivity to him. And at one time in one of the books, he had actually said to his father, after a bloody encounter of seeing his father fight, he said, "I never want to be like you. I just don't want it. I want my book." He always had a book with him. And then, of course, his character changes, and then he wants to be with his father and fight with him. And everybody's saying, "No, you can't. You've got to go to school. You've got to go and become a scholar. That's where the future lies. Men like us, our time will come when it will end. We need you to go and make the laws and make the peace and argue the toss." So there's always that to-ing and fro-ing. And I just felt, okay, where's Henry now? He's 19, 20 years old. Let's just see what he's doing. And of course, he's rebellious. He's always been rebellious. Like who? Like his father. So I couldn't just bring him in because he had the king's protection. Why? Because a couple of books back, Thomas had saved the Prince of Wales's life again and nearly died in the process. So he had to have a guardian. So that's why we had Gifford, the guy outside the door, and he was his bodyguard. So there was another relationship to play with. And if you build relationships, and let's face it, readers are reading for the characters. It's the characters that are telling the story, not me. It's the characters. And that's why I always say to authors who contact me and they say, "Well, how do we do this? How do I do that?" I've always said, if you've created a character, let the character tell the story. Just let him go. If he wants to turn left instead of right, that's his decision. Go with him. Where are you going to end up? I don't know, but he knows. So although you are sort of pulling the strings, as we know as authors, the character is what's going to take the reader with them. Nothing to do with me, it's the character.
No, I agree. It happens to me all the time. The characters take over.
I mean, I know I'm quite envious of authors who can actually sit and plot a book out. I've never been able to do that on anything I've written. I've got a spark to start. Okay. I know my time period. Fine. So there's a guideline. But the rest of it, we just start and off we go. And in fact, in To Kill a King, as I was writing the book, because I don't know where it was going, I knew I'd brought in Henry and I knew Blackstone was going to do this and the Prince of Wales was going to do that, because that's obviously where they were going for the battle over the Pyrenees. But I thought, well, wonder where we're going after this battle. And I didn't have a clue. I just did not have a clue, but I suspected I knew where I was going to go. I was going to go off and do that. Okay, we'll see where that takes us. So then one dark night, an assassin appeared. News to me. Where did this person come from? And why? Why is this person trying to kill this king? So that's what took the story into a completely different place.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I like about it in a sense, is that I usually have a good idea what the final ending will be. But even then, not always. But what's in between is what makes it interesting for me as a writer.
Yeah, absolutely, because you're going on the journey. We as writers are going on the journey, and we're taking our readers with us. Let's all go together, fellas. Off we go, because it's a mystery to me as well. I think I've only had one book where I knew the ending. Can't remember which one it was. The rest of it could go anyway.
Well, with To Kill a King, and I'm not going to give the ending away, but I suspect that you were right until that last line, because I certainly didn't know whether it was going to go one way or the other. And I suspect you were the same.
Very, very true. Yeah, and yeah, very true. I'll say no more.
No.
That
But it worked really well.
Thank you.
And for about the last three pages, I don't think I breathed
I
because I was trying to work out what was going to happen. And it was like, oh my God, this is it's probably the most tense scene I've ever read in a book.
Oh, thank you.
Because it was just like, I didn't have a clue what you were going to do with this last
Yeah.
scene, whether it, I'd been tears or happy, you know, it was just such a dramatic ending.
Oh, well, that's good. Thank you for that, Sharon. When my editor got the manuscript, she got to the end. When the printout had got to the manuscript, the last half page was on a new page.
Oh,
She said, "Oh my God," she said, "I wonder if we can't get the publisher to put it on just half a page at the back."
yeah.
And it doesn't work that way, of course, you know. But that it was a good idea. I thought, well, that'd be nice. That would take the reader to the nth, you know.
Oh,
Yeah.
yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks, Sharon. That's kind of you to say.
So, what are you working? Can you tell us what you're working on now, or?
Well, okay, yes. I can sort of tell you. January 2023, I had delivered To Kill a King to my publisher, and I went to have a meeting with him and my agent. And I thought, well, okay, what are we going to do next? Because, you know, I've got a thriller series as well about the Englishman.
Yeah.
So I thought they'll probably want me to do that. But in truth, To Kill a King had been a really, to me at least, it was a hard year's work. The structure I kept going back to, just to get that structure, I kept restructuring it and getting it right. So I thought, I really do need a break. So I said, well, you know, thanks, guys. You know, I've been working since I was 14 years old. I think I'm going to take a break now, you know. So they said, oh, no. So I said, well, what do you want? You know, so they said, well, we'd like you to do a standalone novel just to take a breather between the Master of War and Ragland, the Englishman, the thriller series. I said, a standalone novel? So they said, yeah, we'd like you to do that because I'd done a couple of them before in between my series, you know. So I said, well, don't really have an idea. I said, oh gosh, okay. Well, I tell you what, I've got this title. I've had this title that's just been nagging away at me, and I don't know what it's about. It's just a title. So I told them the title. They said, that sounds absolutely perfect. I said, but that's just a title, guys. You know, I don't really have a story. And they said, well, what do you think it could be about? So I said, well, it could be about a young man. And I really dug a hole for myself here. I said, many years ago, I was at Dartmouth Castle down. I live in South Devon. I said, I was down at Dartmouth Castle, and there was a plaque commemorating a young boy who, with his family, had been seized by Barbary pirates. That's it. That's the story. So I there and then sort of fleshed it out. And so I've just delivered that. So even when I was sick, I was getting out of bed, writing 2 hours a day, back to bed. So I was off in Italy, researching that in September. I was in Venice in October, and then I engaged a private tour guide in Venice because that's where the book ends up. In fact, most of the book is in Venice, and that is set in the early 17th century in 1604. That is the book. The title is called. Do you want me to tell you the title?
It's up to you if you'd like to, that's fine.
Oh yes,
Well,
please.
I'm always wary of doing this
Yes.
because titles can get changed. But
They
anyway.
can.
Anyway, what triggered this whole mess I got myself into, as it were? It's called The Knife Maker's Apprentice.
Great title.
And it, thank you. And that's what they said. And that's why I've been slugging away every day for the last 12 months. Anyway, so that's The Knife Maker's Apprentice. Ends up in Venice. Anyway, when I got to Venice, I had done an awful lot of research. My word. I have never, in truth, on any book that I've written, I've never had to do so much research. In fact, I think I reached a point where I had to say the research has to stop now, because there were so many elements from day one to the end of the book that I needed to know about in that period of history, and who was doing what and where. And I eventually said, that's it, no more research. I had a contract for how many words I had to write, of course, and way over that. It's a big book. And my wife kept saying to me, haven't you finished this book yet?
As they do.
But then, as they do, because this was literally 7 days a week. And as I said, I'm a bit poorly in the year and I got out of bed, wrote 2 hours, went back to bed, out of bed every day. So I kept saying to her, well, I need two more chapters. And I kept saying, I need two more chapters for at least a month. This book had to be ended a certain way. And I had what I thought was a really good ending. I thought, well, that's clever. And I couldn't get to it, I couldn't make it work. So it didn't happen. So going back to my previous comment, I looked at this character and I said, right, what is the most genuine thing that can happen to this character? And I made it happen. There's going to be an awful lot of unhappy people. No, it's fine. It was a good story. I think I enjoyed the research. I really
Thank
did. But it took me to places I've never been before.
you.
There we are.
Yeah,
There we are.
sounds great. We're all going to be looking forward to that now.
You've got a long way to next February.
Yes. Well, we do we sometimes sort of go rogue and interview somebody about something that's not medieval. So we'll be back to talk to you about that when it comes out.
Oh, well, thank you. It's interesting. It was just and it doesn't sort of, it's character driven. It's character driven. There you are.
Was it nice to be in a different period?
Well, I've done standalones before. I did a book set in the South African Boer War as a standalone, The Last Horseman. I did a book in the World War II, Night Flight to Paris, both of which were very enjoyable for me to write. And because they were, if you like, more recent history, they were more accessible. And I had, I think, and a more easier understanding of the time. To go back now to Renaissance Italy, and not even Renaissance Italy, to 17th century Italy and Algeria and everywhere and England, and think, well, hang on, this is a totally this is an alien world to me. So that's what took the research and the effort, certainly. And
I'll look forward to that.
so it was interesting. The Barbary Pirates, what interested me, of course, then I started then we really start doing the academic research. I was surprised at how much had been done academically about white slavery and how many millions had been taken over the years, and the trade in slavery and how corrupt it was at the time and who was doing what with whom, and Southern Ireland was just a haven for storing booty, and then how did they sail the ships and where did the ships come from? And good God, it went on and on. The Barbary Pirates went all the way up to Iceland. This was an amazing time.
I read a series years ago, and I can't remember the name of the characters, but he was a chap who he was a navy officer who was kidnapped off a navy ship
Wow.
and taken by Barbary pirates, set to work in a harem in Turkey or somewhere. I can't remember the name of the books.
Was that fiction or non-fiction?
Fiction.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know. Gosh. I've seen very little about it. I've seen obviously the historical books. There are a couple of historical books, but the rest of it was really hard digging out research-wise. But that was just because of the way I was writing the story, not trying to change history or anything. It was just how I wrote the story. But it was a bit of an eye-opener, and again, I think it was creating the character that did the job for me, So we'll see what happens. They may or may not like it. Who knows?
Well, you've got a pretty good track record, David.
But you can still be a
Never know.
foot wrong. You never know. So none of until they turn around and say, "Oh, thank you very much. We like that." We spend a year writing these things, and then we move on. Of course, the big test, of course, comes several months later when you're halfway through your next book, and your editor says, "Right, I'm now editing the book you wrote a year and a half ago," and you think, "Okay, what's that about?" And then they ask pertinent questions. Why did this happen then and when?
And you have to go back to the book to remind yourself.
When I was writing television, I was in a producers' meeting and I was writing an awful lot. And I'd written this, I can't remember what it was. I'd written a, was it a film script? No, I can't remember what it was. Anyway, and the producer was very keen. And I had come off this big writing jag. I was really tired. And I went into this meeting, and he was going on very positively about the story and what have you. And this wasn't the character's name. He said, when Jack went into so and so and did this and did that and blah blah blah, and I blanked, and I couldn't remember who Jack was. I totally blanked. And you know when someone speaks to you in a foreign language and you nod and you smile, I had to blag my way out of that one for about 2 3 minutes. And then, who's Jack? Oh God, he's the character I'm talking about. It happens. The brain just disappears. The memory's gone. But there we are. That's a confession on air.
I think we've all been there.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning, David. It's been absolutely fabulous talking to you. And I do recommend everybody goes out and buys and reads To Kill a King, because it is fabulous and that ending is incredible.
Yeah, that's very, very kind of you. Thank you. And it's been great chatting away like this. I've really
Good,
enjoyed
good.
it. Thanks for inviting me. It's great.
Absolute pleasure. And come back next year to talk about the Barbary Pirates.
Well, we'll see you later in the year. We'll see you later in the year at the HNS conference.
Yes.
Oh, yes, of course.
We'll be in touch about that at some point.
Good. Okay. Well, thank you both very much. It's been a delight.
Thank you.
That was brilliant. Thanks, David. I really enjoyed that.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So thank you to David Gilman. Do join us next time when we are going rogue into Roman history. Simon James Atkinson Turney, the one person with a name longer than mine, will be joining us to talk about Agricola or Agricola. Maybe he can tell us the pronunciation. Thank you for listening. I've been Sharon Bennett Connolly.
And I'm Derek Burks. Thanks for listening. Do subscribe to avoid missing one of our episodes. If you enjoyed it, perhaps you might give us a like. And if you have time, we'd love to have a rating or a review from you. So join us next time.